Did you know that calypso music influenced the Beatles and even made its way into a Paddington movie? Today, we will explore the profound influence of Caribbean music on British culture, from the post-World War II era to the present day. We'll focus on the Windrush generation alongside a number of other artists who use their art to navigate cultural identity and leave a lasting legacy on British culture.
Lord Kitchener.
Lord Kitchener. Now, I'm told that you are really the king of calypso singers, is that right?
Yes, that's
well, now, will you sing for us?
Right now.
Yes.
London is the place for me. London is
the place for me. The story of Caribbean music's influence on British culture begins with the arrival of the Windrush generation, a wave of Caribbean migrants who moved to the UK after World War II. This migration marked a transition from colonial subjects to British citizens, involving legal, political, cultural and social transformations.
The accommodation, you go along some part in Nottingham, you would see sign put up rooms for rent, no niggers need apply. Rooms for rent, now and again you see no Irish or niggers. That's not unusual. And that is the sort of conditions that existed.
As a starting point, it's important to understand the context that shaped this era. Was this apparent about turn on immigration policies by Great Britain due to the horrors of World War II or due to the sharp demand for labour to rebuild a war-ravaged country?
Yes and no. I think there was an undercurrent of that for sure. And I actually think that some of the people working in the colonial office, you know, in Britain were kind of the most fervent proponents of you know, Commonwealth, like, you know, the sort of pro-imperial stance is also a pro-Commonwealth stance, and this idea that, yeah, and there was, I think, a sense of gratitude. You know, it was the empire that allowed us to win the war, all that kind of thing. But I actually think that, and there's been some research done on this, but that actually one of the main engines behind the passage of the British Nationality Act wasn't actually, it was actually a response to growing sort of cultural independence that was happening in the quote unquote white Commonwealth. So happening in Australia and happening in Canada, you have at this time, Canada is, it's coming out with its own Canadian passports versus British passports, things like that. And actually the British Nationality Act was partly an attempt to kind of reinforce those ties to like Canada and Australia, right? So it, you can say that it is partly this sense of like, oh, we're all one Commonwealth family and all that kind of thing. But there, I think there's actually some research to show that it was actually an attempt to consolidate and strengthen those ties so that if you were Canadian or Australian or something, you could still move to Britain. You could still become a full British citizenship, or sorry, a full British citizen. But actually the first, you know, it was really, I think, the British Caribbean that was one of the first parts of the empire that kind of really harnessed the power of that Nationality Act to and then later India and Pakistan and stuff. So yeah, so there is a kind of less positive spin on the British Nationality Act for sure, but I do think there was that undercurrent of gratitude and of having high hopes for the Commonwealth, even as some colonies are starting to become independent. I do think that was part of it as well.
The Nationalities Act was a crucial development that facilitated the migration of the Windrush generation. This influx not only addressed the labour shortage, but also brought a rich cultural infusion, particularly notable in the music scene. Now, how did the Nationalities Act and the subsequent arrival of the Windrush generation influence the evolution of calypso music?
The voyage of the first, that voyage of the Windrush is now seen as a watershed moment. Sort of the boat that brought the kind of first boatload of I don't like to call them immigrants because legally speaking, they weren't immigrants. They were migrants or settlers or whatever, but brought that first group over from the West Indies. Like, for example, you know, I look at Calypso in my book a little bit, and Lord Kitchener was actually on the Windrush. So he was actually interviewed for like a newsreel from that voyage, and he sings a little bit of a calypso, "London is the place for me." And that is probably the most, as far as like the people I'm looking at, that is, it might maybe in Britain now, one of the most famous moments is Lord Kitchener singing that song, going over this song kind of full of optimism and hope and that sort of thing. So yeah, no, the Windrush is, and, you know, I did have people ask me, like, why didn't you start your book? Because I say 1945 to 1965. It's like, well, why didn't you start it with the Windrush instead? Why, like, that is the moment that's seen as so historic. And I didn't want to do that because I wanted to have a little bit of continuity with the Second World War, because, of course, the war was such a huge impetus behind the movement of people. A lot of these people who were on the Windrush had fought in the war or had already been to England because they had come over for their war service and that sort of thing. So I didn't want to make it seem like, oh, there were no Black people in London. And then, you know, when the Windrush came, then everything changed. It's like, no, actually, you have to go back a little further. So I actually started at the end of the war instead of with the Windrush. But yeah, still very, now seen as very seminal.
Lord Kitchener, a calypso musician from Trinidad, was among the first passengers of the Empire Windrush. But he wasn't the only one. We've heard his voice and traced his influences to a Paddington movie, but who exactly is Lord Kitchener and why is his impact so significant?
Well, I mean, he wasn't the only... he wasn't the only, you know, calypsonian who settled in London around this time. I want to talk about calypso because it actually was a bit of a cultural touchstone. It doesn't fit in as easily with the kind of community of artists that I look at in the rest of the book. But what I find so fascinating about calypso in London, and there were several of these calypso songs that were recorded. And you can now with the internet, you can probably find them all online. But I actually went to the British Library and I listened to as many of these songs as I could. And what I like about the kind of the calypsos is that it was this way of sort of immediately connecting with, wider British audiences at the time. Cy Grant, who I talk about a little bit, he became famous because he went on BBC Tonight, which was this sort of like popular kind of current events show. And he would sing the news as a calypso. He would they would pan over to him and he would sing a little calypso about something happening. And a lot of the calypsos that were written, this was very much about catering to your audience. But of course, that's what calypso is. Calypso is about, it's always very current. It's about talking about whatever's happening right now. And that was true in the Caribbean as well, in Trinidad, but then it was transported to London. And so there's all these calypsos about, you know, they're like, okay, well, what would we sing about? And so there's calypsos about rationing, and there's calypsos about, you know, interracial marriage, and there's, you know, all kinds of stuff. There's a pretty bawdy calypso about women police in England, that there were female police officers and that kind of thing, and how wouldn't it be great to be arrested by a British female police officer and things like that. But I think that was actually something that the wider kind of British audience, you know, it was fun, and it was like, oh wow, look, here are these settlers coming in, and this is their take on what's happening in England right now and that kind of thing. So yeah, I do think that is why that song "London is the Place for Me" has become, that's why it's so memorable. It's one of the things people still I think of when they think about this era.
It's quite clear that Lord Kitchener was a significant figure, yet his influence was part of a broader movement that included individuals such as Cy Grant and many others. So I have to ask, can you dive into some specific ways these artists influenced British culture and perhaps share examples of their enduring impact?
Well, I was really I was kind of coming at it as a newbie, and I was coming at it as a British cultural historian, right? So when I came over for the first time to do archival research, I turned to, you know, I was like, oh, I was looking at this almost through an institutional lens. You know, I'm like, I'm going to the archives at the BBC. You know, I'm going to the archives at the Royal Court Theatre. I'm seeing what's there. And I remember going to the BBC Written Archives for the first time and getting there, you know, going out to Reading and getting there and going, I might be here for half an hour and then I'm going to have to leave because there's not going to be anything. Like I there hadn't been a whole lot written, and I had some names. But of course, once I started looking, I was like, oh, I had to keep going back because, you know, you do go down the rabbit hole. You look at one file and then you go, oh, who's this person? And then you ask for another file and that kind of thing. So I really was, I really had to follow that kind of trail of breadcrumbs. And it's a different kind of trail than another historian might follow. But I was kind of doing this kind of institutional archival search. And so even with the people that I do look at, I was really looking at their work within these institutions. They did other stuff, but there's not as much of an archival trail for a lot of that other stuff. I mean, the thing to always remember is that this is an extremely small group of people and a very fledgling group of people. I'm sure we'll talk about this again today. And not even necessarily a really self-conscious community in that sense. They're all kind of, you know, coming from different places, different interests. And that doesn't coalesce into a really recognizable community until later. I was really guided by, okay, what can I find and what was there? And of course, when I was doing this research, it was the age of the internet, but nothing like it is now. A lot of this was still, I had to go and hoof it down to the archives and look at what's in these paper folders. So that's what guided me a lot. It's like, okay, who was actually managing to produce stuff that was getting enough of an audience that was, you know, often, you know, it's like, you know, not someone just writing a play, but actually writing a play that gets put on by something that then actually goes into the archives and that sort of thing. Yeah, that's really the trail. It was pretty organic.
Calypso music was a critical medium for the Windrush generation, vocalizing their struggles and aspirations in a world where music remains a potent force for social change. Now, were the Windrush generation's Calypso artists drawn together by their shared challenges stemming from their collective identity, or was it simply by the nature of their artistry itself?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a great question, and it is a tough question, and I had to grapple with it. I mean, there was a lot of thought that went behind calling this book the West Indian Generation, because realistically, none of these people would have actually thought of themselves as West Indian, because even within the Caribbean, that is a huge geographic area. And it's really, you know, each one of those islands or each one of those nations, if you're talking about the non-island British Caribbean, like British Guyana, they all have their own identities. So in a sense, they don't really become West Indian until they move to England. And then that is how people in Britain are referring to them as West Indian, right? They're kind of putting them in that group. And then, it is often, it is that kind of in, you know, that also gets, I think, internalized or accepted or used in the same way by the members of the group themselves, even though that's not necessarily some kind of identity that was organic that they had growing up, right? But once once they're in London and you all of a sudden you're a pretty small community to begin with, then you start going, okay, you know, let's try to kind of form this community. And that was actually one of the reasons why I ended my survey in 1965, which was around the time of the, I think it was 1966, the formation of the Caribbean Artists Movement. And that was, I think, the first sort of really conscious, larger scale attempt to go, okay, you know, let's organize ourselves as a group. Let's meet as a group, and let's look at Caribbean culture in London as a group. And you can actually, you know, there are transcripts of these early meetings, and multiple people are sitting there going, like, wow, this is actually the first time I've ever sat in a room with all of you. This is the first time, a lot of times they didn't know each other. Or it's like, this is the first time I've ever sat in a room with a bunch of people all from the Caribbean. You know, this was not something that, you know, was really going on. And I really think a lot of credit has to go to someone. I look at Pearl Connor, who was an artist in her own right, but I feel like her real legacy in British history is that she was a community builder, and she was amazing. If anyone was a community builder, out of all the people that I look at, it was her. And she was sort of basically an informal agent for any kind of artist. It was like, are you an artist from the Commonwealth? It wasn't just the West Indies. Are you an artist from the Commonwealth? Like, you know, I'll try to get you work. She had connections at the BBC. She cultivated. And so if there was any kind of a community, it was her. I mean, she knew what was going on. But you're absolutely right. I think that, yeah, this community does it. It starts to kind of coalesce by default, but it takes some time. And actually, to answer a question that you asked earlier about if there was anyone that I didn't look at and that I would have liked to, I would say there was a graphic designer named Althea McNish. And she was actually, I think, at some of these early meetings of the Caribbean artist movement. But I've always been really interested in design. I actually did some research earlier in my career on British industrial design in this time period. And she actually became, quite a successful like textile designer and graphic designer for like the Liberty Company and that kind of thing. And I would love to know more. I really didn't find a lot, but now with resources, there would be more. You'd be able to find out about her. You know, she was definitely an interesting name.
The Windrush generation, whether artist or not, faced an array of challenges from racial discrimination to employment issues. Now, what concerns did Calypso artists discuss in their work, and how were these concerns voiced?
Well, I can partially answer that question. And I think it's a question that doesn't just apply to the Calypso artists. And I think it applies to all the artists. And that was something that I really did want to kind of point out in this interview, which is that it is tough. It's kind of a bit futile to try to separate. And this is true of if you're looking at any kind of cultural history, any kind of artist, to separate, okay, what are they really feeling? What are their real concerns in their heart versus what are they doing in order to make money, in order to get a job and all that kind of thing. And that's very pertinent in this case, because of course, you know, it's not like there's a ton of work floating around for these artists, right? And so they are very, and that wouldn't even have been, it's not like they were sellouts or something. This is what artists do in order to get by. It's like, you know, they're making pitches for things that they think will get picked up. They are, they're like going, okay, what does the audience want? What is there an appetite for in England? And that is, there's even a kind of reference to this in, there's a short story by Sam Selvin that, who is a Caribbean writer, and it takes place in London. And he did some great writing, sort of set right in this time period in the 1950s. And there's these two Caribbean settlers, and they're, you know, they're like, okay, you know, we should write a calypso, you know. The British, they like topical stuff. So what are we going to write about, you know? And it really gets at that. It's like, okay, very much catering to, you know, I imagine if you went to like a live performance at the time, it would be different from what actually ends up getting recorded, right? But doesn't matter. There's still overlap. And I think with all of these artists is like, again, this is what's so fascinating about them is that, yes, they were this kind of interesting, unique kind of transition generation, and they are in their own lives making that transition from being British subjects to British citizens, and they are navigating life in England as adults. And it's not like they were born in London and grew up and that's all they know. They are kind of They are meditating on the similarities and the differences between where they grew up and where they are now. And so, for example, I mean, honestly, a lot of these calypsos I probably can't remember anymore, and I have to go back to my book. But one of them is was called "If You're Not White, You're Black," and you know that was, you know, really drawing a distinction between in a lot of places in the Caribbean, it was sort of, instead of being like a black and white race based sort of hierarchy, social hierarchy, it was very much color based. So you know, it was seen as being better to be lighter skinned. So, you know, I think, you know, you could have a brother or a sister who was lighter skinned than you, and they might actually get a better job than you because, you know, just because of the color of your skin. But this calypso is about, actually, now that we're in England, that doesn't apply anymore. You know, if you're not white, you're black. And, you know, and I think Lloyd Record, his first, he made a short film independently and called 10 Bob in Winter. And it gets at that too. It gets at how there's like snobbery between lighter skinned and darker skinned people. And that it's like, what are you doing? We're in England now. That, you know, that doesn't apply. Right. So you can see that. But, you know, all of these artists were kind of in the moment, reacting, you know, Barry Record very much so in his plays, you know, very much reacting to his own, you know, what he was seeing around him in his own life. And I mean, I remember in the archives at the BBC after the passage of the Commonwealth Immigrations Bill, which in 1961, so that would have been the introduction of immigration restriction after this period of openness. And there are, you know, letters in there written from Pearl Connor to her contacts at the BBC saying, this is terrible. We need to, you know, we need to do something. And like her basically trying to come up with ideas for programming and things that could the BBC could do in order to protest this or counteract this or, you know, because it was very much seen as, you know, turning their back on that connection to the Commonwealth and that connection to the empire. So you can see, you do see them trying to, they all had, you know, their power was, their agency was limited in a lot of ways, but what agency they did have, there really was this attempt to use it.
The unique perspectives and artistic expressions of this generation not only enriched the British art scene, but also created a dialogue that influenced British culture in ways that still resonate today. We've seen calypso music influence the Beatles and Paddington, but to what extent did the work of these artists resonate and leave a lasting imprint on British culture?
Well, there's a couple of things you said that struck me. The first thing, and I'd like to point this out, is that it's not like they were getting so much screen time. I mean, I was sort of like, what can I find? And I'm looking at it, it doesn't mean that this was in people's faces 24/7. It wasn't, but it was. I mean, the transition that, you know, from the perspective of, say, like the BBC, or from, you know, mainstream, you know, white audiences in Britain, the transition is from this Britain that people see of as white, which was, of course, never. It was always a fiction. but the movement of sort of these sort of discrete group of settlers who are coming on, you know, ships like the Windrush and arriving. This is all covered by the newsreels and stuff. You know, it was seen as like, oh, our society is changing. It's visibly changing. And it's causing friction, increasingly so, and attitudes towards it, I would say, overall get worse. But they're in flux for a while. And I kind of like that you use this word comfort, because I do think that, you know, if you look at some of these productions, I think that is, you know, although, you know, they never use that word, but now that you say it like that, I mean, there is this sense of like, of coming to terms and coming to terms in a way that gives people a sense of you know, learning more about it, being a kind of comforting presence. The one thing I found in the BBC archives that always sticks with me is Edra Connor, who was a very powerful singer in a very kind of powerful resonant voice, and he, you know, sang gospel and all that kind of thing. But when he came over, he had already done a lot of research into folklore in his own country, and folk songs, and specifically folk songs. He was very musical. And one of the pitches he made to the BBC was for a show that never got made. But he said, this is what it would be. It would be him. It would be called Edra Connor's Other Island, which I think is a really great, even the title is a great, you know, putting, you know, his island origins and putting them in the same frame as the British Isles or whatever. And, you know, drawing a connection between them. And he was like, this is what it would be. It would be him and a little English girl. And she would be taking him on a tour of England and Britain, and she would be taking him, introducing him to all these places, and they would be learning about folk songs, local songs in each of those places. And then Edra Connor would sing one of those songs, and then he would also sing a song from Trinidad that was similar in some way. So here he was pitching a song that is basically like teaching viewers about their own country, teaching our viewers or listeners, excuse me, about, because I think it was for radio. I think it was for television actually. But drawing those connections to, you know, these cultural connections that, you know, for him would be top of mind. He would see those connections. So it's sort of like, you know, instead of focusing on differences, it's all about focusing on connection, shared history. And I think that it's really hard to say that there wasn't, it's really hard to say, oh, there was this set of common concerns about, among all these artists, because there wasn't in that sense. But if you look at everything, one thing you can see is a desire to, and a value placed upon that connection, and a desire to, and this very, very much dovetailed with what the BBC wanted to do, because of course the BBC has always wanted to educate, right, British audiences, right? So this idea of not pushing Britain's kind of imperial past or imperial legacy to the side, and it also wasn't about overlooking all the bad stuff. It was about coming to terms with that, and it was about integrating that into what Britain is and what it means to be British, and then using that knowledge to kind of move forward. And I think from like the BBC's perspective, and a lot of these cultural producers who are kind of, you know, making movies about, right, it was about okay, let's make this understandable. Let's make this something that, you know, viewers can internalize, and like that we can all move forward in a positive way. I'm putting a very positive spin on that, but I do think there was a little bit of a sense of optimism and opportunity there that later gets lost, and it's still there flickering. There's still this sense that maybe you can move forward, that we can see our similarities and all that kind of thing. There's the sense that, you know, maybe we can cultivate that. I do feel like the opportunity gets foreclosed later in, like, by the 1970s, it starts to kind of sputter out. We haven't talked much about Barry Record, who put on multiple plays at the Royal Court Theatre, but I really do think he's a great example, because, you know, now the Royal Court is very much seen as like a British institution of sort of like cutting edge theatre. Putting on plays by new playwrights, new voices, and that kind of thing. But the Royal Court was very new in the 1950s, and it's gotten a lot of, you know, now there's a zillion studies done on the Royal Court Theatre, and a lot of it in this era, and a lot of it is because of the play Look Back in Anger, which was like the big kind of breakout. And the royal court was very much about new voices, and again about, you know, playwrights in Britain writing about, yeah, like what is happening right now. And I mean, I feel like that's the value in a play like Look Back in Anger, in that it's like it really does showcase a moment in time for like your kind of working class, you know, white working class man at that time. And I really do think that, and they put on, in the sort of period I'm looking at, they put on three plays by Barry Record. And I think that it's a real shame that I feel like, because none of, except for Look Back in Anger, like most of these plays didn't make money. But there's so much stuff written about, you know, like lots of other royal court playwrights. And I don't know why there wasn't, Barry Record wasn't kind of really included in all that stuff, because I feel like his stuff, for example, is really of a piece with that. I feel like it really dovetailed with what the royal court was trying to do. And if you look at especially his second play he put on, which was, I think it was put on at the royal court upstairs, so it was a smaller production, but it was a play called You in Your Small Corner, and it got good reviews at the time and that sort of thing. But it is so much, it is so reminiscent of a play like Look Back in Anger. And I think Barry Record in some ways was like your quintessential, like, angry young man. He totally was. And I feel like because he was from Jamaica, it's like, he's like, oh, he was like the, even it's like, oh, he was a West Indian playwright. It was like, he was part of this group of West Indian artists. And I'm like, He really was a part of this royal court group of artists. The fact that he's from Jamaica, and the fact that a couple of his plays do, only his first couple of plays do talk about race. It's so much a part of that. It's so much a part of that stream of British culture. And it's so artificial, I think, to look at what he was doing as a separate thing. And I think he was only adding to that because he was, you know, whereas if you look at the royal court plays, it's like, yeah, they're looking at masculinity, they're looking at gender, they're looking at class, and you've got them all those boxes are ticked off. And then he was looking at all those things too. He was looking at class and gender and all that kind of thing, but he was also looking at race, and he was looking at immigration and that experience, and he was just adding that in. And it was just another element to kind of add to this picture of contemporary Britain in the moment, right? And so I really, you know, from my perspective, I'm like, the legacy of these artists, in, if we're looking at the long haul, should be that they weren't this like, the artists I'm looking at, they weren't necessarily this like reactionary, destabilizing kind of cultural thread. I think really in some ways they slotted right in to kind of the British post-war cultural narrative. All they did was they expanded it and made it and kind of just brought in, you know, more interesting kind of commentary and concerns that that were still kind of very much a reflection on what was going on in the moment, just like the Calypsos, right? Yeah, and I feel like that should be their legacy. And you know, when you first kind of talk, you know, pose this question, it's like, oh, you know, what's their influence today and that kind of thing. I mean, my knee-jerk reaction is to say, I don't even know how much of an influence they have, because I really do feel like this group has been overshadowed historically by sort of the later history of like Black British, which wouldn't have been the term used in the 1950s, but like Black British culture that comes to the fore in like the 1970s and 1980s and does have a little bit of a different set of concerns. And I feel like the concerns of my artists don't fit really neatly into that narrative. And so I think maybe for that reason, they were overlooked for a while. And I think that is starting to change. And I think that is partly starting to change again, I think, because of the internet. And because now I think some of this work, you know, you can probably find much more readily than even I could when I was working on this like 10 years ago or whatever. So
cultural institutions, including the BBC and the wider British public, interacted with these artists in a number of different ways. Could you provide us some insight into the challenges these artists faced in their journey from colonial subjects to domestic citizens?
I mean, I'm really glad you asked this question, because I always worry when I talk about this that I'm about my work, that I'm painting this picture of like everyone got along, and it was which was not the case. But because I think the nature of my research was that I was looking at instances of collaboration, well, that's the picture I'm looking at. I'm looking at how this collaboration played out. And I think when you talk about resistance and challenges, I think it's at looking at the limitations of that collaboration, because a lot of these artists, you know, some of them encountered sort of initial success. After a certain point, it's like they would encounter resistance. It was like there was openness up to a point, and then there would be kind of roadblocks later down the line. Lloyd Record talks about this. So Lloyd Record was he was Barry Record's brother, and so Barry Record was primarily a playwright. Lloyd Record actually started off as an actor, and his sort of initial claim to fame was he was one half of the first on-screen interracial kiss in a TV movie called Hot Summer Night. And so it was in, you know, and, you know, I sort of quote him in my book, but it's like, you know, he talks about, oh, it was great. I was in the papers. It was famous. There were pictures and, you know, everywhere. And he said, you know, and he thought, oh, I'm going to be famous. Like, I've got it made. This was my big break. And then he said he basically just kept getting offered the same part over and over again. And he said, you know, there would be little differences. Sometimes the white parents would love me and sometimes they would hate me. And da da da. He said, but basically it was the same role. And he kind of got frustrated. He actually ended up moving back to Jamaica, but he made a couple of short films in England, and that are now seen as kind of watershed historic in independent films, right? Independent Black British films. But at the time, you know, he was definitely a frustrated artist. And you see it in other ways too, you know. And Cy Grant had the same problem with being typecast. And like the thing with Cy Grant is like, he was very talented, and he became very visible because he was the one who sang these little calypso songs on BBC Tonight. It's like BBC Tonight had like a viewership of like 9 million people or something. So he was legit famous. And he was also like very clean cut, very kind of, you know, kind of classically handsome, and very popular. He had a, you know, great kind of demeanor, stage persona, very warm, kind of charming kind of person. And, you know, he in some ways would have been a good candidate for kind of like leading man status. That was, you know, he had all the things. But basically you can see in the archives, you can see the resistance towards you know, this sort of sense like the BBC like doesn't know what to do with him, because they don't really see him as a leading man, even though that's sort of naturally what you think, where you think he would go. And so they kind of didn't know how to cast him because there were limits to, you know, limits to that kind of welcome. Like, how much are you going to, you know, how are you going to place this person in the public eye? And he probably had more, I don't know as much about this, but he had more opportunities. Almost he was in like a few Hollywood films and that kind of thing, as sort of like secondary characters. So you very much saw that with Edric Connor as well, who was very talented. He did all kinds of stuff. He did all kinds of stuff for the BBC, lots of contracts. And it was when he was really interested in becoming more of a director or producer. And that wouldn't have been that unusual. That's not like that would that kind of track within the BBC. It was not like unheard of to take that kind of a track. You know, it's its own little family, right? Or it certainly was at the time, right? You knew the right people and you could kind of do that. And he took, there was like a BBC like director's course and he took it and he sort of did that stuff. And he was really interested in like making shows about Caribbean culture and going to the Caribbean and like filming Carnival there and that sort of thing. And the response from the BBC was very lukewarm. Like they were not into it. And it was like, why would you go and take this live footage when we could do a much more professional job in our studios? And it's like, they just didn't get it, right? Like, they just weren't getting it. He really wanted to kind of get at this authentic Caribbean culture. And so he became frustrated as well. So there was this collaboration and there were these sort of shared priorities up to a point. But you can see that in different ways, those kind of start to break down. Yeah.
We've explored the challenges, cultural transitions, and artistic expressions of the Windrush generation and other pivotal artists. Now, I have to ask, during your research, did you come across anything unexpected or surprising? And what actually initially attracted you to explore this subject in the first place?
I started off in Nova Scotia. That's where I started my university career. I got into British history specifically. I had, you know, not a whole lot of historical knowledge growing up or anything like that. But my first British history professor, Dr. Stephen Brooke, was a real inspiration. He was really interested in cultural history. So I sort of, you know, got into it that way. I've always loved the mid-century period. I've always loved the 1950s. I think as a historian with the 1950s, you have to do a little digging. The 1960s are seen as kind of revolutionary moment where a lot of things are bursting to the surface, a lot of frustrations. And I feel like in the 50s, that's where that's starting to percolate. I think right after the war, there's a lot of sense that things can change, a lot of opportunity. But there's also kind of going against that, this desire to get back to normal, to get back to the way things were after the upheaval of the war and all that kind of thing. And so that does cause some kind of simmering frustration under the surface. And I've always really liked looking at that just as a historian. When I started my PhD, you know, even studying the British Empire wasn't really on the radar for me. It was obviously something that I was expected to do as a British historian, and I got more and more interested in it. And, you know, at that time, you know, it was all about kind of studying identity, gender identity, class identity, and that was sort of where my interest lay. Then I started studying national identity, which, of course, in the context of the British Empire is so fascinating. And I learned about, you know, I started learning about a little bit about kind of Black British history and the history of immigration. And there was this period between about 1948 and 1961 where Britain passed the British Nationality Act, which was kind of a really, you know, interesting kind of moment in time because this act basically stated that if you were a British subject from anywhere in the world or a member of the British Commonwealth, because, of course, India and Pakistan would have just gotten their own independence. It basically stated that if you moved from anywhere in the British Empire and you moved to England, you were automatically awarded kind of full British citizenship. There was not a lot of red tape or paperwork or anything like that. And I just thought, wow, like what an amazing kind of moment for any kind of settlers coming from anywhere in the British Empire, because they were kind of this unique generation, right? They were both kind of British subjects and British citizens. And so as a historian, I was very kind of academic interest. It was like, well, how does that play out in how they how they express themselves, right? As their British identity. How does that come out in the work they do and that kind of thing? So that kind of led me down the rabbit hole for sure. Well, it's kind of neat because, like I say, you know, this was research I did a long time ago, and it was kind of neat to kind of meditate on, okay, what after all this time has stuck with me, right? That I still kind of remember. And one of the things is what I just talked about, which is the way narratives of race and racism can change. And, you know, people don't even notice, but, you know, the way responsibility can shift or get shifted. But the other things that really stay with me are things like, is the extent to which these artists who have been labeled like West Indian artists or, you know, first generation Black British artists, and the way that whole thing can overlook these really obvious connections that, you know, actually, if we don't look at them as Black British artists and we just look at them as British artists, we can see connections like, I haven't talked at all about Ronald Booty, the sculptor. There has been work on other Caribbean artists that is kind of similar that I kind of discovered. Leon Wainwright has written about like Aubrey Williams and Frank Bowling in the same way. But what I really struggled when I was looking in the archives at the Tate Gallery about Ronald Moody, who was a Jamaican sculptor. And he is actually the oldest person that I look at. He first came over to England in interwar period. And like a lot of these artists, he did not pursue creative stuff until after he had settled in England. He actually came over to become a dentist, to train as a dentist, and he did. And he actually became a dentist. And he subsidized his artwork by being a dentist. But it's really interesting to see the way his work and the history of his work has been presented, how it's shifted multiple times in how he's categorized and that sort of thing. You know, and he resisted for a long time. He resisted this label of him even being a Caribbean artist. He resisted the label of him being a Black British artist. There's this letter in the archives of like this girl who was doing a school project, and she had written him a letter because she wanted to do her project on him because she was doing something about Black British artists. And she was just in grade school, and he wrote her back, and he was like, well, and he was very nice. And he said, you know, I'm happy to talk to you about, and I can be whatever you want me to be. If you want me to be a Black British artist, then that's what I can be. But it was very clear that he did not categorize himself that way. And he talks about this. He talks about the moment. He had a whole story about the moment that he knew he wanted to become a sculptor. And for him, it was when he first went to the British Museum when he was a student in London, and he saw the giant Egyptian stone sculptures. And he was so blown away by them. You know, he's like, they were, you know, these are sculptures, they're not moving, they don't seem to have any expression, and yet they kind of hit you in the gut with their power, you know, the monumental power of. And so he got into a lot of, because of that, he got into looking at a lot of non-Western sculpture and that kind of thing. And if you look at his sculpture, it is very much a piece of that. And I think partly because of that, they're like, oh, he's this kind of West Indian sculptor who's doing this kind of like, you know, this kind of West Indian style of sculpture. But actually, he was just like, and this blew my mind, because in the course of doing research on him, I was doing some reading about other famous British sculptors at the time, like Henry Moore and Barbara Hepworth. And Barbara Hepworth has her story of what made her want to become a sculptor and how she got into looking at non-Western sculpture. And guess what? It was when she first saw the Egyptian It's the same exact Egyptian sculptures that were held at the British Museum, although in her case, she had seen them in a slideshow at school. But it was the exact same formative moment for both of them. And she's this white British lady. And you know, Ronald Moody, he was so much a part of the European art world. And there was the whole kind of mania for like primitivism in art, the whole mania for non-Western art. And you know, he had, for him, it was all about universalism, the idea that he felt that non-Western art was better at kind of getting to kind of these universal themes, hitting you right in the gut. And so that is why he followed that. And it had nothing really to do with his background, his racial background or his imperial background or anything. In fact, he was, you know, his connections were with the European art world and formed by his own experiences in Europe in the war, because he had to escape, him and his wife had to escape France on foot when the Nazis invaded. And so he was a real anti-war, anti-nuclear activist as well. So to me, it's like, wow, you know, those connections get overlooked if you're too hasty to go, oh, this is this West Indian community of, it's like, okay, you know, it's true. And I think that, and later on, he really does start to think about that. And he does kind of incorporate that into some of his work and all that sort of thing. But that's not necessarily always the motivating thing. And it's like, let's actually see this as, I'm being long-winded, but when I started this just comes to mind right now. When I started preparing my proposal for this research, I hadn't done any of this research in London. I was in Boston, and I was in my kind of thesis proposal class with all my other cohort, and I had a great professor for that class. But one thing he said when I first talked about wanting to look at Black British culture in the 50s and that sort of thing, he said, you know, he said, you want to be careful. He said, he basically was telling me that he was cautioning me against making my research too niche, too specific. He's like, whatever you talk about, you want it to be about British history. You don't want to be writing a thesis about Black British history. You want to be writing a thesis about British history. And I was sitting there going, if I'm writing about Black British culture, I am writing about British culture. You know what I mean? It's not niche. You know, you're talking to a bunch of PhD students who are looking at some tiny little facet of whatever their field is. I said, doing Black British culture, there's nothing too niche about that. And that was my knee-jerk kind of internal response to that kind of criticism. And then once I went and did the research, that's when it really hit me how true that was. It's like, you know, these artists, they are not coming in from outside, you know, they are a part of, and that is, I think, very much what their identity was as well. You know, they grew up getting British style educations. They were mostly middle class. You know, they knew their Shakespeare, they knew their Charles Dickens, you know, all that kind of stuff. And they came over and they could, you know, in some ways kind of really beautifully and productively share their vision of what it means to be British. And I feel like if maybe people had embraced that vision a bit more, you know, things might have turned out a little differently, right?
We've discussed a plethora of artists and examples illustrating their long-lasting influence on British culture. If you had the chance to meet any of the artists you study, who would it be and what would you ask them?
I think Pearl Connor would definitely be at the top of the list. You know, again, you don't see a whole lot of traces of her, but they did, she did do some interviews later in life, and she would have been like a pretty old woman. And she was still like so sharp. Her memory was so sharp. And she at the time, she could read the room. And she is like, man, she worked hard and she knew what had to be done. And there's this glimpse of her in the transcripts from, there was a particularly contentious early meeting of the Caribbean artist movement in like 1966 or 1967. And it was like the actors, it was like the drama people. And it was between, Lloyd Record was actually one of the people arguing. But basically, it really distilled a lot about the shift between the generation of artists that I look at and later generations, because there was a sort of newer group and they had put on a play, just an independent play about Caribbean culture. And they were like, it was so beautiful. It was so beautiful. And they're like, we don't, you know, it was kind of, the attitude was like, we don't need these kind of British standards of like, you know, what makes good theater. We don't need, you know, we don't need that kind of patronage. It's like just doing what we're doing and embracing our culture. That is a beautiful thing. And Lloyd Record came in and was like, no, because he was old school. He was like, I saw that. It was garbage. He said it wasn't good. He said it wasn't a good play. And he said, I don't care what any of you say. He said, I am going to listen. I'd rather listen to, like, you know, I can't remember who was, but he was like, I'd rather use Shakespeare as my touchstone. This white man, I'd rather use him. And it was this real clash. They were really fighting. And then Pearl Connor, who must have been sitting there watching it all of a sudden you can see her appear in the transcript and she just shuts them down. You know, it's like she just got it. It's like, look, the point is here is we're here to create. Just, you know, whichever way you're coming at it, like, I get it. I get that you're fighting about this, but this is not productive. This is not going to get us where we need to know. This is not going to get our work out, da 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 da. And I just thought, oh, wow, she, you know, I felt like she in that sense, you could see her as being the bridge. It's like, it's all good. Let's move forward. So her for sure. And Barry Record was, he was really opinionated, and he was really iconoclastic. He would have disagreed disagreed with everybody, but he was super smart, and I think he would be a pretty entertaining dinner guest. I would just let him talk. He didn't hold back either, so...
Now, with Amanda's guidance, we have cast a spotlight on the challenges, cultural transitions, and artistic expressions of the Windrush generation and other pivotal artists, unraveling their transformative influence in reshaping British culture and identity. As we reflect on the indelible legacy left by these artists, I have to ask Amanda what her final thoughts are.
I mean, the only thing I would say is that I, you know, in some ways, I look back on my research now and the even the political climate has changed, you know, since, you know, this book came out. And I'm very aware, I was at the time, for sure, but I would say I'm even more aware now of, like, my own, you know, status as sort of like this middle-class white Canadian woman. It's like, what am I doing even writing about any of this? And I really do see now that I can see my own personality in my research, in that, you know, it's probably not a coincidence. I'm a very non-confrontational person. and I think it's probably not a coincidence that I chose to focus on instances of collaboration and cooperation. You know, when I go into the archives, that is actually what jumped out at me. It's probably not, you know, history is never, ever neutral, and writing history is never neutral. And I guess that what I would want to close with is that with my book, I am absolutely not trying to kind of overturn, you know, what's already out there. I think that racial conflict is a framework that that is, you know, that when you're looking at post-war Black British history, racial conflict is a primary framework through which history is viewed by historians. And I think that there's a lot of very, very, very good reasons for that. And with my book, I am not trying to overturn any of that or say that it's faulty or wrong. It's not. This is just sort of, it's just sort of an extra thing. I think by looking at these instances of collaboration, you actually get a different perspective on when you do see the resistance and you do see the limitations, you can start to see how those came about. And so it's again, it's just a little added thing. So that's the only little disclaimer I would add.
To wrap up, I can only say thank you to Amanda for sharing her insights and research with us, and thank you to everyone who's listened for joining us on this journey. We hope you've gained a deeper understanding of the impact of Caribbean music and culture on British culture and identity. And that's the end of another intriguing podcast episode. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed creating this podcast. If you're passionate about the work I'm doing and want to support it, consider becoming a paid YouTube member to unlock some cool features or join our Patreon community. You can find the link in the description below. Thanks again for tuning in, and I'll hopefully see you in the next video. Bye.